This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The American character is defined by perseverance against the odds, hard work, and industry. Keep your nose to the grindstone, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, and the early bird gets the worm. And if you get rich in this process, well, you've earned it. We make our own luck. Or did Horatio Alger play the lottery? While Americans tout the virtues of the work ethic, there's an ongoing fascination with con men and gamblers. Nothing more American than the big score. Finding a gusher may take talent and hard work for sure, but also maybe an appeal to Dame Fortune. How many young girls beelined for Schwab's drugstore 50 years ago, hoping luck would find them the same way it discovered Lana Turner? In a new book, Jackson Lears argues that the mingling of Native American, African, and European Catholic cultures with the British American Protestantism has given us a unique and contradictory relationship with chance. We romanticize gambling even as we condemn it. Later in this program, we'll hear about the filmmakers hoping to hit it big at the Sundance Festival in Utah. But first, luck in America. What role do you assign to chance? In a universe of logic, do you carry a rabbit's foot? Does gambling exaggerate the value of money or reduce it to a tool? Is success a byproduct of hard work and failure just bad luck? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Jackson Lears joins us now from the studios at Rutgers University. His new book is called Something for Nothing, Luck in America. And thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
Professor, your last book was about advertising. How did you get interested in luck?
Well, the subject of advertising opened up the whole irrational side of the American economy and of market culture to me. I began to realize how much advertising and, in turn, economic growth depended on longings, fantasies, desires for magical self-transformation that advertisers began to appeal to systematically as early as the patent medicine era in the early 1800s. And of course, they've been appealing successfully to those longings for a kind of personal transformation ever since. And this sort of opened up a whole new perspective for me on the American economy and on market culture generally, and it was only a short step really from looking at the fantasies cultivated and courted by advertisers to the fantasies and longings of gamblers.
To combine your those two interests, reminded of the ad for the Maryland Lottery, which went along the lines of a jingle, but it went along the lines of everybody's got a dream and every day somebody's dream comes true.
Absolutely. There's a powerful element, of course, of fantasy and longing in all of the lottery advertising that you see, and I think a lot of people play the lottery as a kind of hope maintenance tax, even if they rationally may know that they have about as much chance of winning the lottery as they do of discovering oil in their backyards.
Mm-hmm.
They want to keep that possibility open. It gives them a sense that life is maybe not as bleak and predictable and routine as it sometimes seems, that there is a way out if they can only cash in on it.
Now, you, in your book, posit two different and competing cultures in America, the culture of chance and the culture of control. Tell us a little bit about both.
Sure. Well, the culture of chance really came into my mind as a concept, I guess you could say, back in the mid-90s. I had a kind of epiphany on a subway platform in Lower Manhattan when I was waiting in line for a token, and I saw this even longer line stretching around me at the lottery machine, the lottery ticket machine, and I realized this was at the height of the so-called Republican Revolution of the mid-90s, the Gingrich Revolution, the contract with America, and the din of calls for personal moral responsibility and stripping away welfare and dependency in all its forms, and an emphasis on precisely those values you were alluding to at the outset, the notion that everyone should pull himself or herself up by their bootstraps. And in the midst of all of this talk about personal economic responsibility, here was this line of gamblers, here was this line of people who were paying homage to a very different deity, it seemed to me. And I began to wonder, was there a gambler's worldview? Was there a way to connect gambling with something more than just the usual suspects of vices? And by that I mean alcoholism, prostitution, and the litany that usually comes along in the wake of any mention of gambling. And it seemed to me in the end that there was a gambler's worldview, and that the gambler's dice had a deep connection in many ways to the soothsayer's bones, that gamblers, like many other people who have courted chance through various kinds of rituals, tried to make sense of the universe, were conjuring luck, or at least the hope of it, and that at bottom there were connections between longings for luck and longings for grace in many religious traditions, certainly Christianity, where grace functions as a kind of spiritual luck. It's something that happens to you. It's not something that you can will or control. It's something that descends from on high. And I think this is part of the desire that animates gamblers. So the subject of gambling was a port of entry, really, into a much larger subject, which was what I came to call the culture of chance, which involved a willingness to leave things to chance, to let random events be a source of knowledge, a portal of possibility, a willingness to give up our obsession with controlling outcomes, a willingness to play and to acknowledge the uncertainty of outcomes in many cases. If you think about, for example, the connections between the artist and the grip of inspiration, and the athlete who is in the zone, you'll find, I think, in both cases, a kind of willingness to give up the attempt to control the outcome. That is, a willingness to let go and let the creative spirit carry that person, that athlete or that artist, where he or she wants to go. And yet, it's not something that you can make happen. It's not something that you can force. We all, I think, have had the experience, or many of us have anyway, of watching or being the person in a sport or game who is trying to aim the ball, if he's a pitcher or if he's serving in a tennis match. And I think we often find that things come out better when we just let things happen, when we, in fact, do let go and play. So there are various connections between play and gambling and grace that, it seemed to me, ultimately came to light in the course of this study. The contrast with that culture of chance, which I think is much more open to possibility and incomplete explanation than we've given it credit for, the contrast to that is what I think of as our official culture, our sort of dominant ethos in this society. And that's what I call the culture of control, which involves a rejection of uncertainty, an insistence on the human ability to master fate in partnership with God or with technology, and in the end, a kind of secular version of providence where there's a perfect match between merit and reward. We have successful individuals who are successful from this point of view, from the culture of control's point of view, because they deserve to be. And we have nations which are successful, presumably as well, in the outcome of international struggles, because they deserve to be as well. So we have ultimately a belief in providence, that is, the divinely ordained predictability of fate, that somehow slips into secular life where it was never meant to be, and sanctions the accumulation of wealth, for example, by individuals who may or may not have worked hard for it. The truly lucky in the society usually deny the very existence of luck. And we also have the accumulation of power by nations like our own, which then believe that this power is somehow divinely ordained, and that this nation therefore has a sacred role to play in the drama of world history. So providence can be very dangerous, it seems to me, when it's adapted to secular purposes, whether they're individual or national. And it's what I think of as really the core of the culture of control, because it sanctions the work ethic, the faith in disciplined achievement. And I certainly don't deny the importance of disciplined achievement in attaining any particular end. It almost always has to be taken into account. There's an element of hard work involved, but often hard work doesn't bring the results that we claim it will bring, and often those results come as a result of anything but hard work, as a result of mere chance. So this conflict between control and chance is, of course, virtually universal, but I think especially sharp in the U.S., because we've always had a sense of ourselves as a righteous community, a redeemer nation, a city on a hill, on the one hand. But on the other hand, as you pointed out at the outset, we have observers like Alexis de Tocqueville, the extraordinarily perceptive Frenchman who came here in the 1820s, who described American commerce as a vast lottery. And I think Tocqueville understood that a lot of people got involved in that lottery, that is, a lot of people undertook business enterprise, partly because of the sheer excitement involved in the risk-taking and the uncertainty.
Our guest is Our guest is Jackson Lears. His new book is Something for Nothing, Luck in America. What role does luck play in your life? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. And let's go get some listeners involved. Our first caller is David, who's on the line with us from Soldotna in Alaska.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Well, my comment on chance is it seems that in order for chance to really take a part in your life, it needs to be there's always a question that is being asked There is a level of opportunism that you, to a certain sense, you're looking for an answer, and then it doesn't necessarily fall in your lap as the way we see chance, but there's usually sort of a question being asked or something that you're looking for, and then I'll take my response off the air, but do you kind of see my point where I'm going with this?
Well, Jackson, do you?
I think I do, yeah. There are a number of famous scientists, for example, Pasteur and Alexander Fleming and others who have said from time to time that fortune favors the prepared mind, or luck or chance favors the prepared mind. There's a way of being in position for good things to happen. There's no guarantee of that, but I think that there are ways to educate oneself, to attune oneself to possibilities, to remain open to the unexpected and the unpredictable that do in fact allow for the creation of great art or breakthroughs in science or inspired improvisation in jazz. There's a whole range of chance-related activities that don't involve just passive waiting for things to happen, but that do involve a kind of active participation with fortune or luck or chance or whatever the force at the core of the cosmos may be. And I think that what I want to argue in this book is not to elevate chance over control, but to rebalance the two and suggest that we need to give chance its due more than we have in the past.
We're talking about luck. How's yours? Do you succeed through hard work or depend on happenstance? Give us a call. We'll take more of your questions after a break. 800-989-8255 or send us email at totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cohn in Washington. We're talking about America's relationship with luck. Do you control your own destiny or follow fortune's fancy? Our guest is Jackson Lears, author of a new book called Something for Nothing, Luck in America. He's at Rutgers University. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Take your chances. Give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And Let's go right back to the phones. Jim joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Thanks for taking my call. I was interested in the comment that he made about like athletes being in the zone, and he also went on to comment about how musicians can do incredible improvisation. And I know I've personally experienced where I've worked on a piece, and it's just been incredibly difficult. And then all of a sudden, it's like inspiration or something just grabs. And if you don't pay attention, it just happens. And I know I've referred to the whole process as if it was Star Wars and letting the Force be with me.
Is that what you were talking about, Jackson Lears?
Oh, I think so. I think that musicians have lots of experiences like this, and they certainly have to be immersed in the tradition, whatever traditions they're working in, before they can improvise successfully. That's part of the preparation I was talking about earlier. But then once you are there, then it's much more likely that these wonderful moments are going to occur when there is a kind of opening and a freshening.
Yeah, I was interested. You drew a comparison to artists, for example, the collage artist Joseph Cornell, who used literally found objects in his work.
Absolutely. I think that this is a powerful tradition in 20th century American art, and a lot of it is, I think, rooted in a reaction against the feeling that this has become a kind of over-organized, routinized society, and that one could find the most interesting and exciting prods to creativity often by accident, and there is a kind of aesthetic of accident in our avant-garde tradition, certainly, and it's often combined, certainly in the case of Cornell, and at its most interesting, I think, with the real craftsmanship and the real exercise of artistic intention. So there's another instance of chance and control coexisting.
Jim?
I think another thing that's kind of amazing about the process is that once it happens, it kind of gives you so much hope that it's going to happen again, and invariably it does. And it's really inspiring and fulfilling.
Well, thanks very much. What do you play, Jim?
I play in a bluegrass band. And if you know anything about bluegrass, sometimes it gets fast and furious. And to keep up the pace, it's like Jackson said, that, first you have to do the preparation, but once you've done the preparation, the inspiration just seems to come, and the more you do it, the more the inspiration seems to come. So, like I said, it's really fulfilling.
Good for you, Jim. Nothing
Thank
like
you very
it.
Much.
Thanks very much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's go now to Ross, and Ross is with us from St. Louis.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller. I've been listening since Ray Suarez used to host the show.
Well, welcome, then.
Thank you. I'm going to make a comment and then get off the phone. I think of luck as basically falling into three categories. I was fortunate enough to be born a white male in the late 20th century in the United States to a middle-class family with a background of education and so forth, and all of that kind of stuff kind of came easily to me. I wasn't born into money, and I wasn't born into family, so I guess those are circumstances that I wasn't fortunate in that respect.
So your last name is not Rockefeller?
No. Then there's, I guess, the second category of luck, which is what's been under discussion here, which is being alert to opportunities which present themselves and being prepared to act on them. And I guess the third category would be what I would call dumb luck. And my comment there is that my chances of winning the lottery are only slightly lower than if I actually played. So I'll take any response off the phone.
Yeah, it reminds me. Thanks very much, Ross, of the comment that the lottery's a tax on dumb people. But anyway, go ahead, Jackson.
Well, I think that's a very interesting breakdown of different sorts of luck, and I would certainly agree that the luck of birth, even if it's just into comparative comfort and security and not actual great wealth, is still tremendously important and often overlooked by most of us, and certainly overlooked in our public discourse much of the time when we try to puzzle out how to allocate resources in this society. So I think that's important. Of course, I would argue that's a kind of dumb luck, too, in that we certainly don't have any control over it or any ability to influence it through skill or calculation. It's just something that happens.
We got an email from Steve Jeske in Waukesha, Wisconsin. When it comes to luck, he writes, I've got it. Over the past 10 years, I've won in excess of 100 radio contests plus a couple of literal little lottery prizes. These winnings have kept my family and friends in free concert and movie tickets, dinners out, sports and boat show passes, zoo and museum memberships, video rental, CD, DVDs, videos, and shirts and hats. It's become a running joke. So guess what I won on the radio today? No big score, a house or a car trip or something like that, but I'm happy with my little prizes, and it's fun to share them with luck. And are there people who seem to just attract luck?
Well, there certainly are over the years, although I guess if you stay at it long enough, whatever it is you're trying to be lucky at, your luck will probably run a little thin sooner or later.
Sooner or later.
It doesn't run out altogether, but that's, of course, behind the aphorism, all horse players die broke, that Damon Runyon reported from his world in the 1930s and 40s. The assumption that the true risk taker is going to keep risk-taking risks until sooner or later they don't pan out. But I certainly don't want to be a doomsayer with respect to this correspondent. It sounds like he's on a hot streak and he ought to stay there.
Let's go now to Makai, who's with us from Sacramento, California.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment was, is May 1st, 1999, I was out in the backyard talking to my neighbor, and I had an epiphany. I knew exactly what I wanted. I didn't want to have to work anymore, but most of all, I wanted to spend more time with my husband. And that night, I won the California lottery.
So you decided to be lucky, and you were lucky.
Yeah, that was it. It's basically a conscious choice of you are where you want to be, and once you realize that everything that you were doing led you up to that point, you can decide from that point on where you want to go.
Did you do anything to summon this luck other than think about it?
Well, like I've been lucky in other things. I won a trip to Woodstock for free and got to see it in 94. And so I've always, you know, like if I really want something, I think about it, you know, and basically I, you know, like I enter contests only if I want to win it. We took a trip down to a company picnic, and the reason why I wanted to go is to win a prize, and I did, you know. So my husband's pretty much, you know, in awe of it. But we went to Woodstock. We talked to a group of people, and there was the people that won, and then their partners, most of them couldn't win nothing. So it's kind of interesting.
Hmm. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks very much. Jackson Lear has mentioned earlier Damon Runyon's famous remark about all horse players dying broke. We're going to talk with one in just a moment. I don't think he'll die broke, but we'll see. Wanted to read this email question for you, though. What role did the California Gold Rush play in the development of our relationship with luck? That was clearly a case of people abandoning the idea of traditional work and embracing the idea of chance. That from Reynolds Watkins.
Well, that's an event that occupies a central place in my narrative. Certainly, I would agree. It's a moment when risk really seemed to pay off. Though there again, the number of people who were actually successful paled by comparison to the number who went home empty-handed. And, mm-hmm. and a lot of the people who went to California in 1849. A student of mine, Brian Roberts, has written a book about this, actually, on the California Gold Rush, in which he discovered that a lot of the people who went there were actually pretty well off to begin with. They were certainly respectable and middle to upper class men, and they were looking for an adventure. They were looking for an opportunity to play, to throw caution to the winds. Another thing about the Gold Rush that I think is interesting is that there was a period, I think, during the first few years after gold was discovered, when there was a kind of alternative economic ethos at work, and in some ways it's similar to the ethos that is at work in Damon Runyon's world as well. That comment about all horse players dying broke also referred to generosity, and the unwillingness ever to turn down a tapped out friend who needed a loan. So the same kind of ethos was at work, according to the observers who were on the premises at the time, in San Francisco in the 1849 period and soon after. That is an ethic of where money was meant to circulate rather than accumulate, and hoarding was in some ways the chief sin. And there was a tremendous emphasis on acquiring status through giving away as much as you could, or at least spreading it around as much as possible. And that there again, that's another dimension of this culture of chance that I think is often overlooked, is the element of reckless generosity, which is also associated, in my mind at least, with the experience of grace.
Well, joining us now from Hallandale, Florida, is Andy Beyer. He writes the horse racing column for the Washington Post and is the author of many books on handicapping and on betting. His probably his most famous is Beyer on Speed. Andy Beyer, always good to talk to you.
Hi, Neil.
Do you consider yourself a professional gambler?
Yes. I have an honest job in addition, but I certainly approach the game in what I consider a professional fashion and bet seriously.
What role does luck play in gambling?
Well, it's not something I think about a lot. When I'm when I'm studying the races, as this winter at Gulfstream, every day I'm spending hours watching films of races and taking notes on the horses, calculating my speed figures, poring over the daily racing form. So, when I bet a race, I'm always thinking, gee, I hope I'm right, rather than thinking, gee, I want to be lucky today. But because, horse racing, like just about every other, activity known to man, has a significant element of, the unforeseeable or the random to it. The specter of luck is always kind of, lurking over my shoulder. Lots of bad things can happen to good opinions at the racetrack.
I think the phrase is, there's a million ways to lose a horse race.
Exactly.
And I think you've explored most of them, Andy.
I certainly have a long chronicle of hard luck stories, as does every horse player.
As does every horse player. Do you see, as you're looking there, this had to be luck? What happened there? Because you win sometimes. Your breaks fall your way.
Well, I guess you would like to think that that the good and the bad breaks will even out over a period of time, although they really don't. And I suppose that's a silly statement. If you're going through an intersection and get hit by a truck, that might have missed you 1 second earlier, you don't say, well, gee, this is you're going to even out over time. Some of the sometimes in the pivotal events of your life and the pivotal bets, luck plays a big hand and maybe changes the course of your life. It's happened to me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Andy Beyer, you mentioned it had happened to you. What do you mean?
What I would consider the pivotal bet of my life was back in 1970, when I was sort of a fledgling horse player. I was doing very badly at the track. I had just recently started writing a horse racing column for the old Washington Daily News, and I spotted a horse at a track in Pennsylvania that I fell in love with, decided I was going to bet all of my dwindling bankroll on him, and wrote a column in the paper saying, this horse can't lose, stop worrying about your Christmas money. I went to the track, and it was like one of those Hollywood scenarios. The horse was a million lengths behind, made a tremendous charge through the stretch. It was a head-bobbing photo finish, decided by a fraction of an inch. You couldn't tell from the naked eye. And I said to the goddess of wagering, if you give me this one, I'll never ask for another break. Well, the horse lost by a nose. The jockey claimed foul. 10 minutes later, they disqualified the winner, put the horse up at 20-1. And I've never had a broke day since.
there are some people who can bet fairly heavily at the racetrack who try to take all the luck out of it. They will wait for a dominant horse, somebody on the scale of a Secretary. Well, that only comes across once a generation, but a dominant horse, and look for him to be in a great spot and then go bet $50,000 on him to show, come in third.
Probably the worst strategy there is, because even with Secretariat, I mean, even with situations that that look on papers if they should be surefire, there's always something bad that can happen. Secretariat won once by 10 and was disqualified. This is a gambling game. You're dealing with risk. You can't take the risk out of it. As I say, we're all driven slightly crazy by all the random bad breaks that can go against us. But it's part of the game. I think the for a gambler, the key is not to be unhinged by bad luck, because if you start getting in a negative frame of mind, it just feeds on itself and kind of erodes the way you think.
We just have a minute before we have to let you go, Andy, but do gamblers treat money differently than the rest of us working stiffs do?
Oh, I certainly think so. I mean, when I was a young gambler, an old veteran put his arm around me once and said, "Kid, I'm going to give you one piece of advice, and if you don't follow it, you can never win. When you're betting at the track, you got to think of that money as if it's just chips or pebbles, because when you think of it as the legal tender that could pay the next month's rent, you're doomed."
Andy Beyer is speaking with us from the races in Hallandale, Florida. And Andy, you got anything good going today?
I'm always in action.
Andy Beyer writes for the Washington Post and is the author of many books, including Andy Beyer on Speed and My $50,000 Year at the Races, a somewhat older volume. Andy Beyer, always good to talk to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Neil. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about luck in America with Jackson Lears, the author of Something for Nothing, Luck in America. The top stories we're following today here at NPR News: Middle Eastern countries are discussing ways to prevent a war in Iraq. Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan have all sent representatives to Istanbul, Turkey, for the meeting. Also, the U.S. economy's road to recovery has been anything but smooth. A rocky week on Wall Street and a weakened dollar are among the factors that raise questions about the year ahead. We'll hear reports from NPR's Ivan Watson and Jack Spear later today on All Things Considered. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now we're talking with Jackson Lears, author of Something for Nothing, Luck in America. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is John, who's on the line with us from San Diego.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to propose that luck is really nothing more than the odds, in that if for instance you took a penny and you flipped a penny 10 times, you might get 8 or 9 times it would come up heads. But if you flip it 10,000 times, you may get more even between heads and tails. And in our life, perhaps our life is so short that we don't span enough time in our lives for those odds to even out and all of us to receive the same amount of luck. And if we were to, say, live 5 or 10,000 years, that we might all have the same kind of luck over the course of our lives. And if I could stay on the line, because I'm not on the radio, I can't hear the answers.
Oh, okay. Jackson Lears?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation. It pretty much underscores, I don't know if the caller meant it to or not, but it underscores the inapplicability of statistics and probability to everyday human life. I mean,
right.
Statistics and probability are based on the law of large numbers, as this caller implied. If you have an infinite or even a huge, let's just say a huge number of coin tossings, you're eventually going to break it down to about 50-50. But everything that matters in statistics and probability is the aggregate of large, repeated, and separate occurrences of the same event. Whereas we don't experience life that way. We experience life as a series of interconnected events and that are all enmeshed in this web of contingencies, and that are not separable from one another, and that are not infinitely repeatable. So statistics and probability don't really do away with chance or luck at the level of individual experience, unless, of course, we were to live 5,000 years, which doesn't seem to be on the agenda at the moment.
Well, we should be so lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
John, thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Professor Lears, I wanted to ask you before we let you go. I mean, you're almost positing, and at one extreme, sort of this mechanistic, logical view of a technological universe where everything is either explained or about to be, and this almost enchanted vision of this culture of chance, as you call it.
Well, I think that we have two ideal types or principles here, which tend to overlap more than you might imagine or than I acknowledge at the outset. But I'm trying to separate them partly because I want to revalue chance. But I think you can bring the two worlds together in various ways. I think, for example, in politics, the whole example of the welfare state coming into being was a product of a number of reformers and eventually politicians in the early 20th century saying, look, life is governed by chance under capitalism in many ways. People don't always get dealt the same hand from the outset or at various points along the way. And sometimes we can do something about to salve the abrasions of accident. We can do something to manage chance up to a point. We can't eliminate it, but we can bring government in to create social security, job security, unemployment compensation, and the like. And I think this is an example of how you can bring, on the one hand, an acknowledgement of accident and chance in the world together with an impulse to manage chance for humane purposes. And I think that's what, in many ways, the welfare state tried to do. And I think whenever we acknowledge the role of chance in human affairs, we at least open the possibility that we can say about people who are less fortunate, there but for the grace of God go I, in the words of the old cliche. And that observation, it seems to me, leads to the possibility of a more gracious society.
Jackson Lears, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Jackson Lears is a professor of psychology at Rutgers University. His new book is called Something for Nothing, Luck in America. He was speaking with us from the studios at Rutgers University.